I'm Jonathan Capehart, in today for Leonard Lopate. This election season, we've heard lots of platitudes and promises about protecting the middle class, as we've heard in nearly every election for years. But the real facts and figures about what is happening to the middle class paint a disturbing picture. In their new book, The Betrayal of the American Dream, investigative reporters Donald Bartlett and James Steele chronicle the ways that the middle class has been systematically impoverished for decades and identify the individuals, corporations, and politicians responsible. It's published by Public Affairs, and I'm pleased to welcome them both to our show today. Hello, thanks for coming in.
Nice to be here, Jonathan.
So the title of your last book was America, What Went Wrong? So should I assume the same things that you thought were going wrong when you wrote that book in 1992 are still going wrong today, or even worse?
Well, they are, but I'll tell you one thing that's interesting about your question. We experienced a certain amount of criticism back in 1991, 92 when the book came out, even though it was a big bestseller. People said that we were alarmists, that the situation wasn't that bad, that what was going on was just a temporary blip because of a recession at the time, and that once that was over, everything would be okay again. And we documented even then how many of those things had been underway for a period of time. And it turned out, I think, we really did make a mistake in that book. The mistake was we totally underestimated the speed with which the economic elite in this country would consolidate their power and continue to implement those policies, impoverishing the middle class. Tax policies, trade policies, deregulation policies, all of these things, many of them have been in the works for years and years, but particularly in the last 15 to 20 years, far more intense, with far more devastating results for the middle class. I mean, most of the manufacturing employment, I mean, the country's been losing manufacturing for years, but the bulk of it is really in the last 10 years, long after we wrote the original book where we warned that we needed to do something about it. So all of these things have been going on a while, but we had no idea of the speed with which some of these policies would be implemented to the detriment, the terrible detriment of the middle class.
So you wrote that book in 1992, and then what followed was one of the longest periods of expansion and prosperity, people being pulled out of poverty into middle class, and then it all went wrong.
There were some blips in the 90s where things went up a little bit, not great ones, but they certainly would have been promising if that had continued for a period of time. But they were not significant in many ways. The median family income just barely changed during that period. Our trade policies didn't change during that period. So all of the things that have ultimately come to roost were still in the works back at that time. Deregulation, which we wrote about back 20 years ago, continued into the 90s with the financial deregulation. We all know how that worked out in terms of mortgages and so forth. All of that occurred during that time. So the point we make is that the whole deregulation mindset, among other things, has been in the works for like 10, 20, 30 years now, with devastating impacts really on middle-class people, not just jobs, but in the case of financial deregulation, what it's done to their homes, their lifestyle, and just their values.
Don, you want to get in on this?
I think if you look at just pensions, the Cadillac of the pension system was the defined benefit pension plan. I mean, all the big corporations had them. Sears Roebuck had them. J.C. Penney. All the big companies had them, and they guaranteed a fixed monthly pension to their employees. They weren't huge, but they certainly helped with Social Security. It would have given, they gave people enough money to retire on. There's no question about that. And we said at the time, if they keep going the way they're going, there'll be no defined benefit pensions. The only mistake we made in that book was we misjudged how fast things were going to unravel. There's not a defined benefit pension plan in corporate America now accepting new employees. I mean, the old ones that the people were grandfathered under still exist, but the new ones are all basically the pensions are 401ks, which may or may not be there when people retire.
I mean, you write in your book that since 1985, corporations have killed 84,350 pensions.
As much as we knew about these general subjects, that number just blew our mind. We had no idea of the intensity of that because in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, more and more people received pensions, just as Don's mentioning. But then beginning in the 80s, that trend began to reverse. And, of course, taking the place of that has been the 401k.
Right, market-based.
Market-based, plans. And there's nothing wrong with 401ks, but in the beginning, they were never intended to take the place of pensions. In fact, they were originally designed as an aid to corporate executives, as a way to let them shoulder some of their money. But once that began going, those guys looked at this and they say, hey, let's shift our people over into these things. It'll cost us less. Well, administrative costs and an actual upfront cost and ongoing cost.
So it's a matter of saving money.
Saving money all
saving
the way
money
around.
Saving corporation.
Exactly. And then, you know, what the median amount in 401ks now is a whopping $17,000.
Hmm.
You know, that's...
Nobody's going to retire on that.
Oh, well, I'm not even thinking about
well,
retiring. But
that's true.
That's the problem. And then about 2 or 3 months ago, the head of AIG, which... one of the companies that helped bring about the financial collapse, although he wasn't there at the time, Ben Mosh, put out this little notice that people are going to have to work not only until they're 70, but until they're 80. What kind of a world are these people living in? I mean, he's got this great multi-million-dollar pension, so he's fine. It doesn't matter.
Right.
It was interesting. He issued that pronouncement from his vacation villa in Dubrovnik, Croatia.
Nice.
That's right.
If you, yeah.
That's right. I'm on my way over to my villa in Croatia after the show, of course.
Well, let's pull back a second, because your book is entitled "The Betrayal of the American Dream," but we haven't even talked about how we're defining American Dream. Doesn't it mean different things to different people?
It does mean different things to different people. What we generally define it, and obviously there are many definitions, as the notion that each generation coming along can do at least as well or better than their parents. You know, the American dream was achieving a certain amount of prosperity, a certain amount of security, a certain, you might say, foundation of things. And that's what we say has been jeopardized. Now, this isn't true for everybody. There are always going to be some people who do okay. But, I mean, 75% of the people were working during the Great Depression. People forget that. But what kind of a society you have where you have such a substantial number don't have that? And what's in jeopardy is not just the middle class, but it's people aspiring to the middle class. You no longer have that ladder upward that existed for many people, not because they're not hard workers, not because they don't want to sacrifice, but it's just not there because of the economic conditions.
Don?
You hear a lot about people not being self-reliant and not working hard enough and all that stuff. What we do when you go around the country and you interview people, they've done everything they were supposed to do and the jobs are gone. And the other thing, it's interesting now because this campaign is going to turn on creating jobs. There aren't going to be any jobs created, period. But is anybody going to say that? No. Instead, it's going to muddle along as it is now. And, well, there may be an occasional blip up, but just look at what's happening to jobs. Fully a quarter of the jobs that have been created in this downturn are at the bottom of the barrel. They pay next to nothing, and they create this ripple effect in the economy, which means there's less taxes collected, less Social Security collected. So it's a feeding frenzy. The system feeds on itself, and it's feeding downward.
But when you say jobs aren't going to be created, are you saying jobs aren't going to be created at the level they were
created
pre-2008 implosion?
Well, let's go back to – oh, yeah. No, I go back
way
before
back
that.
Before that. Yeah.
I would go back before that. They're not going to be created at the level they were in the 70s and 80s, and they are not going to pay anywhere near what they did. One of the successful things that the people at the top have done is pit one segment of middle America, those people in public positions, against people in private positions. They did a very good job of pitting one group of middle America against another. It's a very vicious war that's going to go on, is going on out there now.
The point you make just a second ago, Jonathan, about it's really the good-paying jobs. And one of the things the point we make in the book is you go back many years ago when blue-collar jobs are being threatened and those are the so-called dirty jobs and the plants were going offshore. So many of the experts, so many of the economists says, don't worry about this. We're going to create smart jobs. They're going to be service jobs. They're going to be good-paying jobs, knowledge-based jobs, all of those things. What we show in this book, and this is why this is so much different than the original, or back to the book in 1992, is that so many of those jobs are now going offshore. Good paying jobs. The Labor Department issued a report a few years ago about service jobs that are susceptible to offshoring. We just stumbled across this in the course of the research, and it showed 160 service occupations, 25% of the service industry workforce, 30 million jobs, the Labor Department said, are susceptible to offshoring. Hmm. A lot of these jobs are like aeronautical engineers, pharmacists, all down the line, people making a decent income. So this has moved so far beyond just what you might call the folks at the bottom of the barrel who don't have any education, supposedly. That's what is so severe, and that is what is so dangerous, and nobody's really talking about that.
I'm Jonathan Capehart, in for Leonard Lopate. I'm speaking with Don Bartlett and James Steele about their book, The Betrayal of the American Dream. Do you believe the hollowing out of the middle class is the direct result of intentional government and corporate policies? Emphasis on intentional.
Well, it's certainly the result. And in the case of something, let's just take trade policy. Trade policy has been very much driven by what multinational corporations want to do. So that has been an intentional thing to in every way preach free trade, no barriers. Anytime anybody raises a problem about the way our trading partners treat us in the trade field, everybody says, we can't put up walls around the country. Much of that is driven by the big corporations because that's in their best interest. They love to be able to set up a plant abroad, have those goods made with cheap labor and with an entity subsidized by the Chinese governments or provincial governments. They want that shipped back to the U.S., basically duty-free. That's in their interest. Here domestically, many domestic companies that don't have the wherewithal to do that have been run out of business by that policy because other foreign entities, not based on the U.S., have been able to ship their thing in based on those conditions. So much of that has been driven by interest in which that was very much in their favor. Tax policy has been an intentional thing on the part of the rich just to cut their taxes. There's no doubt about that. What some people didn't realize in the beginning is one of the reasons we have this deficit is because those at the very top are not paying as they once did. You know, and yet now they want to cut the deficit. And who will that impact?
So, I mean, this everything that you talked about, this isn't it's not a partisan issue because you've got Democrats and Republicans, and particularly on trade policy.
Particularly on trade and deregulation, absolutely right.
You know, you have President Clinton who sold the country on NAFTA. President Obama has signed some trade agreements. Well,
that's an important point, Jonathan. NAFTA, Clinton sold. This is going to create all of these jobs. Within 2 years, now we went from a trade surplus with Mexico, which we had for years, to a trade deficit. It has remained a deficit ever since. It didn't create any jobs here. Did it create some? Of course it did.
But there was a
net loss. Yeah. And that's what people fail to see. Everybody's fixated on this, on the deficit. The real problem is the trade deficit. And every month is coming out of newspapers. You know, I look at this and I shudder. Every month, every newspaper in this country, basically every major metropolitan, carries a story that on the trade deficit for the month. Last month it widened. Last month it narrowed. But if you look at it over 40 years, it has gone in only one direction. But does anybody say that? No. And this is an area where the news media bears a huge responsibility.
And we are the only developed country with such a deficit. None of our trading partners tolerate that kind of thing in their own economies.
So why do we continue with these agreements? And why hasn't the public turned on free trade?
Well, Too complicated.
I think a lot of the public has turned on it, but that hasn't translated into policy. I mean, you look at a lot of the public opinion polls and you see where a lot of people, where they are on this issue. And it doesn't require putting walls around everything. But when you have an issue, when you have a country that is not responding to your entreaties to get your products in, we need to take action. Every year, the U.S. Trade Representative issues a report hundreds of pages long about the trade barriers that other countries have to our products. And that was the whole basis of free trade in the beginning. We would open our doors, they would open their doors. But those doors and other places haven't been that open.
And so to push open those doors, the idea would be to go to the WTO or take enforcement action.
You'd have to take some enforcement action.
But nothing – but is it – no country wants to do that, or just the United States
doesn't
want
to? The U.S. is the one – well, the other countries, very often they do it in what they call non-tariff trade barriers. It's not so much a duty. But they figure out ways to make sure domestic industries are not, in their view, unfairly affected. But we haven't figured out a way to deal with that because the doors are so wide open.
You know, one of the countries that people rail against is China.
Yes.
Mitt Romney is campaigning that on day one he is going to tell China, you know, the what for. You know, how realistic is that? I mean, because it's not just trade and it's not just currency. Because if you push China or any country on one thing, the blowback could come from someplace else. And with China, it's that they are buying up all our debt and could turn the lever someplace else to do us harm.
The question is, I don't think they would have that many other places to buy our debt. So I think it's not quite as vulnerable in my mind, though I'm not an economist on that issue, that some people might portray. I think the main issue is, we need to at least, one, recognize what's going on. What the Chinese do, and this is fine, this is their business, this is their government, this is their society. They subsidize companies. They provide all sorts of incentives. There's also cheap labor, but that's only one part of the equation. There's a whole range of other things the Chinese do that make those products cheaper to bring in. We have to have a different mindset in this country, that the lowest possible price for everything is not necessarily going to be the way to go totally. Because where does that ultimately lead? And you see the result right now in median family income. It's been stagnant for decades. And that's one of the reasons, not the only reason, but one of them.
And that's one of the rubs here is that people are upset and angry about jobs going overseas and things that China may or may not be doing. But on the other hand, they still want the cheap goods that they get in return for all that. We have to go to a break. 1 second. I'm speaking with investigative reporters Don Bartlett and James Steele. Their latest book is called The Betrayal of the American Dream. It's published by Public Affairs, and we'll be back with more after a break. Once again, I'm Jonathan Capehart in for Leonard Lopate, speaking with Don Bartlett and James Steele about their new book, The Betrayal of the American Dream. Now, Don, why have the super wealthy seemed to recover from the 08 crash rather well, while most other Americans are still in a financial hole?
Well, the money is concentrated at the top, and that didn't happen overnight. It happened gradually. And the people who represented their interests made sure that it did. If you go, there are two statistics. You know, there's a zillion statistics on taxes, but there are two that if you keep them in mind, that's all you have to remember. And that is in 1955, 51.2% of the money of the 400 richest households went to federal taxes. More than half of their money went to federal taxes. That's 1955. You jump forward to 2007, and that figure falls to 16.6%. That didn't happen. You know, it wasn't like some cataclysmic event out of the sky. It happened as a result of deliberate policies by the super rich and the people who represented them.
And what's interesting about this, you go back to the 50s, 60s, and 70s, you know, there have always been rich people. And this book is an anti-rich people thing or class warfare, any of that kind of malarkey that some of those folks are always talking about. But in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, the track between the rich and the middle class pretty much followed the same line in terms of upward growth in their income and their well-being. It's in the 70s that those lines begin to depart. And from the 70s on, that's gotten sharper and sharper and sharper, leading up to the kind of statistic Don just said. And the reason for this is a whole range of things. I mean, it's tax policy. It's partly trade. Part of it's deregulation. And part of it's the ability to get those things through that work for your advantage. I mean, people say the globalization is the root of a lot of the problems in the middle class. And if every group were, let's say, suffering from that, if their income was stagnant or whatever, you'd say, okay, that's true. But that's not what's happened. there's this terrible, tremendous imbalance between those at the top and those near them versus everybody else. That's not the way this country used to be, and I don't think a lot of young people realize that. This is a marked departure from what this country was in the 50s, 60s, even the 70s.
So in the presidential campaign, but also just in everyday governance, everyone's talking about the Bush tax cuts.
Right.
Where when President Bush came into office, the nation actually had a surplus. President Bush instituted these tax cuts. And now, after the 2008 implosion, and you see all these charts and graphs from all over the place showing just how much of the deficit is a result of those Bush tax cuts. Is it an overstatement to say that the Bush tax cuts are part of the problem?
They're definitely part of the problem. And among those tax cuts, one of them is just the most outrageous one of all. And that is that they cut dividend income taxes to 15%. I mean, dividend income was usually at least what most people pay in wages and salary, their federal income tax rate.
Is that the same as carried interest? No, that's
well,
different.
It's different, yeah. But it has the same result, which is somebody gets a very low tax bill and somebody who doesn't really need a low tax bill but gets it instead. But the 15% on dividend income is absolutely outrageous and totally indefensible. And this is one of the things that would expire if this went through the end of this year. That had never happened before. There was a time in the early 80s, late 70s, where dividend income, if I'm not mistaken, was 70%. If you were very, very wealthy, you would be taxed at 70%. Your salaries, wages, at most would be 50%. Now, these are a lot of numbers, but the point was the idea that dividend income should be treated better than some fellow working on the street here, wages, earnings, or salaries, is totally ridiculous, and it goes to the heart of why this concentration has happened, why there's so much inequality.
I know this is different from carried interest, but it's a perfect way to ask this question about carried interest. So wealthy people, including Mitt Romney, they pay a tax rate at around 15% because a large share of their earnings are what the tax code calls or has labeled carried interest. Please explain that to me. To us, to everyone who's listening.
Well, I'll tell you what it is. If you're in a company and you're paid a salary, you're taxed at whatever the top rate that the federal tax code requires. But what carried interest is, for these people who run these private equity funds, they take a piece of a lot of the deals they do. Though they don't buy those pieces like a regular investor. They're just giving that as part of their process. And that is taxed as though they were investors, which would be 15% because it's like capital gains. Mm-hmm. That's what that's about. Terribly complicated process. But in other words, they're being taxed at 15% for what is, in effect, a lot of their work, their labor, while somebody out here on the street who's got a salary and maybe is making $110,000 or $20,000, their top rate might be 25%. So there's no justification for carried interest. And everybody in the private equity funds has made tremendous amounts of money because of that.
So how much money are wealthy Americans who can take advantage of that, how much are they avoiding in paying taxes as a result of that? Is it even calculable?
Well, no, it's not. Because one of the things that's happened over the years, and this has been another deliberate policy, is IRS no longer really tracks how much money is not being taxed. For years, they had a program called Taxpayer Compliance Measurement Program, in which they took different statistical approaches to coming up with fairly decent estimates on how much money was going untaxed. That stopped years ago because people in Congress wanted it stopped. The last thing people in Congress want is to have IRS collecting taxes from their voters. I mean, you don't get elected by having IRS swoop down and imposing a penalty on you for failing to pay your taxes. So IRS really has been totally emasculated over the last 20, 30 years. And there's nothing on the horizon that's going to change that.
Following up on this carried interest thing, there was a boomlet of interest about, 3 or 4 years ago, to try to take legislative action to curb the carried interest deduction that is clearly both unfair and equitable and cost the Treasury millions of dollars. Well, the industry, the private equity industry and the hedge funds, mounted one of the more successful lobbying campaigns you can imagine, brought their people to Washington saying this will kill jobs, this will deprive teachers and firefighters somewhere of their pensions because we're, which had nothing to do with the salaries these people at the top are making. But this was a Congress much more receptive to certain changes and reform than the one that's in there now. And even that couldn't be done. It made it through, if I'm not mistaken, the Senate, but it did not get through the Congress as a whole because of that lobbying, because of the success. They brought on all the big guns, Henry Kravis, folks like that, actually paid visits on Capitol Hill to try to get this thing turned out. And sure enough, it was. It was turned back.
Was Stephen Schwartzman part of that?
Yes.
Part of that lobbying effort?
Right. Blackstone definitely was part of that.
Right. Stephen Schwartzman at Blackstone. And this was a guy who had this lavish birthday party.
Yes, at the Park Avenue Armory. Exactly.
And that was in 2007.
Right.
Right.
Big thing with Patti LaBelle and...
Rod Stewart was there and...
That sounds all rather random to me, but I mean, I guess if you've got the money.
Marvin Hamlisch was there. Yeah, it took me a second to remember who else was there. So they had all bases covered from all eras.
I was going to say I haven't heard that name in a while. So one of the things that we're obsessed with in Washington, I'm not so sure how much the rest of the country is obsessed with this, but the fiscal cliff.
Right.
All these horrible decisions that Congress has been kicking to the end of the road. Well, the end of the road is December 31st for the most part in terms of Bush tax cuts, raising the debt ceiling, and there's one other horrible thing that I cannot remember right now. But what would be the impact of going over the cliff? Because you see in some instances it says this would be horrible, devastate the country, the middle class, it'll institute a new recession, and other people are saying, we could glide along for a few more weeks.
Who knows? But there's no question it'd be very difficult for bankers. But I don't think there's a lot of sympathy there.
Yeah.
You just don't know what corporations will – and let's back up a minute. We say corporations. When we say that, we're talking about multinational global corporations. Domestic corporations, which really are responsible for the bulk of the employment in this country, are being hammered by Washington because they don't have anywhere near the clout that the multinationals do. And they kind of get tarred a little hugely unfairly in some ways because everybody, including us, we talk about corporations, quote. We're talking about global corporations. Example. They have all this money sitting offshore in bank accounts, trillions, $2 to $3 trillion sitting offshore that they refuse to bring back here unless they are guaranteed a tax rate of less than 5%. What nobody talks about is they've already taken the deductions out of the income to get those profits. They've already, this is a very simple thing to change. You want to keep your money offshore? Fine. You lose all your tax deductions as a corporation until you fulfill your responsibilities.
So how are corporations? You said something earlier. You said domestic corporations. Those
right.
that are here, not the big global behemoths.
Right.
They're being hammered by Washington. How?
Well they really pay taxes at a much higher rate.
Yeah. I mean, technically, the multinational and the domestic, the tax rate is the same. But because of these other write-offs, largely international, the multinational corporation can radically reduce their overall tax bill. But the domestic company that doesn't have that option, some of those people do pay at the maximum rate.
The global companies can move their money around the tax havens of the world and achieve the lowest rate possible. If you're a domestic corporation, you can't do that. You whatever money you make, you're going to pay taxes on.
What's interesting is back in 2003, I believe it was, the same argument came up where these companies that had this money parked offshore, they said, we'd really like to bring it back, but we've got to get a lower tax rate. And Congress said, okay, we'll give that to you, but you better create jobs here. That's the deal. So various reports have shown quite clearly that the largest companies had brought back, in effect, billions of dollars, not tax-free, but a very low tax rate. Most of those companies actually kill jobs in the following years.
So how is that possible? We'll do this, but you must create jobs. Where was the hammer?
It's almost like the trade policy. It's like nobody ever follows up on these things.
There's a carrot, a lot of carrots.
Exactly.
And where's the stick?
Exactly. There is no stick, and that's the problem. And this wouldn't be difficult. Since we started this a couple of days ago, we've gotten some great mail from just ordinary people saying, why isn't this being done? And then they trot out a couple of examples of things that would hold the multinational corporations accountable. They are not held accountable at all for any of their actions, period, no matter what they say they get. Look at the Great Crash. Every one of those is a multinational corporation engaged in all kinds of behavior in their best interest, but not in the best interest of the population at all, at large.
And that's, you see that particularly in trade, too, in addition to the tax policy. I mean, it just goes to the heart of this division in the country.
And what's interesting on trade is this country, Washington, I shouldn't say this country, Washington will go to war at the drop of a hat. Give me an excuse, and we'll send the troops to wherever, Afghanistan, Iraq. Maybe we can go to Iran now. But we'll send the troops anywhere you want. Even hint at the possibility of something that could lead to a trade war, and everyone quakes in their boots. And that's because the people at the top pulling the strings will not permit a trade war.
We're running out of time. We have about a minute left. What would be the – and I want you to each answer this as quickly as you could. What would be the three things that could be done, should be done, that would turn around this betrayal of the American dream? Pie in the sky, because this is – I know is something that can't happen overnight.
Well, taxes are clearly one, but the other thing is – and everybody's going to scream about this. Well, this will add to the deficit, and that's true. But the country needs to embark on some programs that will create jobs. Both parties say they want to create jobs. I think both parties, quite frankly, are lying. If they want to create jobs, create them. You don't. It's sort of like Yoda said, do, don't try. It's not that difficult. Come up with a program, public works program, like Eisenhower with the Interstate Highway, come up with some program that will give the country as a whole some positive benefit as a result of it.
That's Donald Bartlett.
And think about, what if we were at the outset of World War II now and somebody said, okay, we can't spend this money on bombers and the Army and all of those sort of things. What would have happened to that? This is a crisis that we need to invest in the country because companies, corporations aren't. And that's the easiest way to do it.
Thanks very much. I've been speaking with investigative reporters Donald Bartlett and James Steele about their latest book, The Betrayal of the American Dream, is published by Public Affairs. Don and Jim, thank you so much for joining us today.
Nice to be
with
you.
Join guest host Elliot Farris on tomorrow's show. He'll speak with Michael Lemonick about the future of climate change and why it should be called global weirdness. Then, a look at the dark side of SeaWorld and the problems with holding killer whales in captivity. Also, two of the stars of Nice Work If You Can Get It, a new musical comedy which features the music and lyrics of the Gershwins. Plus, Jonah Lehrer explains the nature of creativity. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Blakeney Schick, Stephen Valentino, and Julia Corcoran. Melissa Egan is the executive producer. We had help today from Alex Geller, Judy Joe, Jessica Miller, and Fanny Cohen. Debbie Fountain was at the audio controls. I'm Jonathan Capehart, in for Leonard Lopate. Thanks for listening.